Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology or personalities in political life. A pension is that strange phenomenon, a distant object at the start of your career, which, depending on when you die, is something that you might make use of in later life. But there are so many unknowns about it, including how much will be in the pot by the time you come to take it out. But what is known is that pensions and possible pensions reform are political hot potatoes right now. So to help me peel back the layers of the pension debate, I am delighted to welcome to my couch Baroness Ros Altman, CBE, who is a British life peer, leading UK pensions expert, and former pensions minister. Hello, Ros.
Hi, Lucy.
And listen, before we get on to pensions, were you named after Rosalind in As You Like It?
I believe I was, yes.
Why? Well, because I met a Cordelia last week. So I'm obviously on a Shakespearean streak.
You must be.
I just thought I would ask. I want to start with the auto-enrolment bill, and you've recently steered some really important extensions to it into law. And as you can imagine, I'm fascinated by this, not least because it harnesses some really brilliant psychology around nudging people to start contributing to a pension. So can you say a little bit about what the bill does and how the psychology of that maybe works?
Yeah, well, the bill is really simple. It was actually started by the Tory MP Jonathan Gullis in the Commons, and I took it through the Lords, which has now become law. And the aim of the bill is very simple, really. Anyone who's under 22 at the moment is not automatically put into a pension scheme by their employer at work. They have to request it. This bill will make sure that the under 22s are included as well. And secondly, the bill aims to give particularly the lower earners more pension because the contributions will be based on their entire income, not just a slice above £6,240 a year, which of course for someone who's earning only £10,000 or £11,000 a year gives them very little in the way of employer or their own contributions and any tax relief. So the aim of the bill is to be the next stage in automatic enrolment, which has been a phenomenal success, harnessing, as you rightly say, the behavioural nudge theory, which suggests that people who are already in a pension scheme won't bother to try and leave it. But if they have to do something actively to request to be in the scheme, then they won't bother. And the impact on the young is particularly telling because the numbers of younger people at work who could request a pension and don't do it are enormous. But as soon as you get the 22 pluses auto-enrolled, you get well over 80% of them starting a pension. The 21-year-olds, it's well under 30%. So there is clearly a dramatic psychological, behavioural boost to pensions from using auto-enrolment rather than just telling people you really ought to have a pension and relying on them to choose that.
That's the tricky thing, isn't it? Because there are lots of things that we tell people, you know, don't eat too much sugar, don't drive too fast, that psychologically we have different assessment of risk and we have different assessments of what's going to be useful to us a very long time in the future. And it seems to me that pensions is one thing very specifically that suffers from that sense that it represents something a really long way away in the far future. So how do we, in addition to the nudging technique and this very specific example, how can we engage younger people or even children? Do you think this should be part of the school curriculum, that we talk about pensions?
Absolutely.
And in the way that I think we ought to talk about menopause, why can't we tell them about these kind of things rather than waiting until it's too late?
Well, I think certainly when it comes to managing finance, bank accounts, savings accounts, and pensions, it is ideal if you can include that automatically in the probably the maths curriculum, it could be some other curriculum, to help youngsters understand the power of building up money over time, the compounding of the returns over many years, which gives you much more later on than if you just save a little bit now, and if you don't get investment returns or even any interest on your money. Those are really important messages, as is handling debt. What can you afford? How to manage and budget? All of those things are really important. Mm-hmm. And we haven't yet cracked just how we can help people of all ages understand how to manage money. Part of the problem with pensions has always been the ludicrous complexity of the rules and the jargon that goes around pensions, which makes it almost impossible for any ordinary normal person who hasn't deeply studied and worked with pensions to know what on earth you're talking about when people talk about default funds and those and defined contribution and all those things. You know, it means nothing to people. And understand something, usually you'll switch off. But what has been most interesting to me the last few weeks is that there has been a trial of savings alongside pension, where employers have trialed automatically putting some of their staff's salary, not just into a pension, but alongside that, into a savings account. And once again, the proportion of workers who are not opting out, they could, they have to fill in a form, but they can, who are staying in, is dramatically higher than a previous study whereby employers told their workers that this was on offer and relied on them to use it.
And relied on their motivation. So you need to model it, don't you? You need to actually do it as an employer, or to have that auto-enrollment bill. You're actually showing the person the thing, modeling the behavior rather than just telling them about the behavior.
Well, I think you're forcing the behavior in some way, making it the most difficult path to not do it rather than the most difficult path to do it. And that's clearly a very powerful, you know, the whole financial services industry in some ways built on inertia. You know, people don't like to bother changing their bank account. They know they have to have one. But once they've got one, even if it's offering terrible value, they don't move. You know, the power of inertia and staying with the incumbent provider is enormous. This is a different way of trying to say, well, people won't necessarily do something even when they know it's in their own interest. You know, even people who know they're getting less from the bank account that they're in than they would if they opened another account, don't do it because it's the hassle and the time taken and the trouble. And people like the line of least resistance, it seems. Now, part of that stems from the fact that they don't necessarily understand, because nobody's ever taught either school children or university students workplace properly about the impacts of these things on money later on. But the first stage should be, I think, to use these psychological insights to do what they should do when they're there. And this is what I would love to see as the next stage of auto-enrollment. But of course, pension providers and employers are pretty reluctant. Once you've got everyone in a pension scheme at work, why are we not helping them understand it? Why are we not just explaining to them, you know, what does investment mean? What is their money actually doing? You can take an example company that they have shares in and help people see what that company does and that their money is helping that company grow. Different types of investment. Nobody has a clue what their pension money is doing at any time.
Well, it wasn't until I was researching for this episode that I discovered that you can't usually leave your pension savings in your will. You have to actually nominate someone to receive your pension in case, obviously, you die before they die, that it's not an automatic transfer.
You can leave your pension will be included as part of your estate. But if you fill in what's called an expression of wish form and company, I would like my pension to go specifically to this person or people, it bypasses your estate and it doesn't have any inheritance tax.
Gosh.
Because so if you don't know that, yeah. And if nobody gets, and if someone says to you, oh, you need to fill in an expression of wish form, what does that mean? You won't have a clue. Actually, that could mean you've lost, if you don't do it, 40% of your pension fund if you unfortunately pass away soon. And the person who inherits it, even if that person is benefiting from your will, can't get it directly, has to go through your estate. So it will face the inheritance tax. It's nuts that more pension providers don't automatically write to everybody who's got a pension and say, you must fill in this form, otherwise you could lose 40% of your money.
Well, I think we ought to give a big thumbs up, actually, that they're, for my pension provider, or certainly from one of my previous employers who has actually done that very recently and has sent me that form, which is what kind of got me thinking about it. But it's so interesting, you're talking about that inertia effect.
It's not automatic, that's the problem.
That's right, you've actually got to
you've got to rely on someone else.
Yeah. And hoping, yes, and that's why it would be so much better if that information came out. But I was thinking about, with a general election, maybe less than 12 months' time now, we've had a situation with the triple lock, which one might argue for various political reasons, but also maybe that psychological inertia effect of, do we really want to change it? Do we really want to upset certain sections of the electorate? It's very clear that neither Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer are necessarily at the moment committing to retain the triple lock beyond the next election. So where do you stand on the triple lock debate? I know that it's probably an answer that could last a long time, but do you think it's completely unaffordable?
Actually, you know, the triple lock is another amazing example of psychology in action, because what has happened is that the words triple lock applied to the state pension have just been internalized, it seems, by almost everybody to be shorthand for, we're protecting pensioners. And any indication that you might be removing this thing called triple lock, which most people couldn't explain to you, would automatically mean you're going to be letting down pensioners, obviously, particularly poorer ones, who don't have a private pension or anything else to live on. That is simply not true. But trying to get the truth through the political debate, which has boiled it down to this almost one-line totemic symbol of triple lock means great protection for all pensioners, has made it almost impossible to get the truth. If you got the truth, you would see that the triple lock has run its course, it's done its job, And for several years now, it has been pretty outdated and unfair, both inter and intra generationally, because it gives most protection to the youngest pensioners, who arguably need it least because they're more likely to have a private pension than the very elderly. And it protects the full new state pension, which is over £200 a week for those pensioners who are below about age 71 or 72. And it only protects just over £150 a week for the older ones, who anyone who reached pension age before 2016. Now, just explaining that has probably lost people, and I'm very sorry for your listeners if it is complicated, but it is. But even worse than that is that the pension credit bit that the national insurance system pays on a means-tested basis to the very poorest pensioners is also not covered. So this has become understood, misrepresented symbol as the power of mass psychology and the media, which turn this thing into something that makes very little sense from a social perspective, also costs taxpayers a lot more money than is necessary. And the bit of the triple lock that adds unnecessary costs for sure is the 2.5% at the moment. The triple lock means if you're a state pensioner, the state pension goes up by the highest of earnings, price inflation, or 2.5%. 2.5% is just a random, pretty much random number. It has no economic or social significance. It did help pensioners catch up with the rest of the population between 2010 and 2016, when they'd fallen very far behind. But it's done its job. And now we've got the new state pension system. It's actually working unfairly. But most people don't understand it. And even the oldest pensioners are saying, don't take away my triple lock, without realizing what it really could mean, which is, you know, for example, if you move to a double lock, you still get the best of price or earnings inflation. But there might be cost savings in the long run to the public purse.
But we're not really explaining that. And do you think the timing of this debate?
You're one of the only people
who's writing about this consistently, and it has, because I mean it's partly because you're a former pensions minister, but also because you have as your passion, you know, making life better for the elderly. And I was just thinking about the timing of this triple lock debate, not just because of the general election, but also coming on the back of a very peculiar period with the pandemic and the lockdowns and the impact that that also had on elderly people. There's been a lot of talk naturally about the impact that it had on the very young, kids not going to school, not being socialized, not being able to interact with their friends. But for the older generation, the pandemic had the potential to be hugely negative, particularly around their mental health. And do you think that's another reason why the triple lock debate feels so febrile? Because it's yet more focus on the way in which society is treating the elderly, or not?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, clearly the isolated elderly suffered hugely during the pandemic, and many older people and their families were particularly hard hit by lockdowns, which they would have loved not to have to keep so strictly, so that they could, who were dying, or could see grandchildren if grandchildren really wanted to come. You did get suicides from people who'd been cut off from their nothing else and felt they had nothing else. So clearly, there's a big element of hardship caused to older people by the pandemic. However, at the same time, there's this narrative, which is that all younger people during the pandemic had to suffer these deprivations to protect older people, because the older people were the most vulnerable. And so you've had a very strange narrative. Depending on who you are and who you want to listen to, you can either paint it as being, we all looked after the elderly at the expense of the young, or we abandoned the elderly, especially those in care homes. And didn't look after them in the way that we should have done. Mm. But the triple lock somehow for me is slightly tangential to that, because it is something that reflects our society's values and norms. And if you try to end the whole state pension system, because people don't say, oh, we get rid of the triple lock, they end up saying we can't afford the state pension at all. And we've got to means test everybody, and we've got to pay less. Well, we already pay the lowest state pension in the developed world. You know, it's not like we pay a king's ransom.
Lowest in real terms, or relative terms, relative to people's salaries. How is that statistic calculated?
That's the OECD figure, which suggests that ours are the lowest in the developed world. Obviously, you can say all sorts of things with statistics, but let's say it's one of the lowest.
Yeah.
We're certainly not one of the poorest countries in the OECD. So this is a political choice, and that's where this stems from, I think. If a politician wants to tell these pensioner voters that they believe will vote in greater numbers than other age groups, that they care about them and have their best interests at heart, just bandying around the words triple lock is a very convenient, quick way to dismiss that and say, okay, we've sorted pensioners, now let's move on. Mm. Even though it's not true, even though it misses out the poorest, even though it gives much less to the eldest, who normally, if you'd ask the street, who do you think needs more taxpayer money spent on them? Do you think it's the younger pensioners or the older ones? They would normally answer the older ones. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what we are now seeing is a narrative that's growing, which is we can't afford state pension. We can't afford to look after these old people, because all old people now are much better off than the young, and they've all got great other pensions, and they had free university education and all this stuff, which is absolutely not true. You know, the vast majority of today's pensioners haven't got much, if any, private pension, especially women. And even in my day, less than 10% of people went to university. So the fact that anyone got free university tuition, and I plead guilty to that, is not really relevant when you compare with today's generations or the development of society. So I do worry very much that the about pensions and pensioners are adding to social strife. You know, we're all a society. If we don't pull together and look after each other, I can't. And if you've got this intergenerational tension where young people resent old people getting even a very low amount of money in the state pension system, then you're setting up, I think, a dangerous trend for the future. And also, what you are ignoring is that, yes, of course, there are intergenerational unfairnesses, but there are also huge intra-generational unfairnesses, with many pensioners having little or nothing more than the state pension to survive on. And as I said before, a basic state pension is around £150 a week. Even the full new one is around 200. How many people would think you can have a decent lifestyle on 8,000 or £10,000 a year?
So do you think this coming general election, just finally, do you think this could be, for a brave politician, the moment where this debate actually gets examined for the benefit of all pensioners, but particularly those who are the poorest, that actually this next 12 months could see a redefining of how British society supports its elderly?
You broke up then, Lucy.
My final question is, do you think then that with this general election in the offing in the next 12 months, that this could be the golden opportunity for a politician who's brave enough to say, we need to revisit the way in which this pension debate takes place so that we can actually protect the poorest pensioners in society? But can you see a politician doing that in the next 12 months?
I'll tell you the truth, Lucy, I sincerely it does not happen, because my view is, and always has been, pensions should not be a political football. They are too important. For me, pensions are not just about money. They are about people. And it's person's life later on, when they absolutely can't work and have worked through their life on the understanding that they will have at least some societal support later, to then say, well, one political party is going to do this and the other one's going to do that. I hope that we will sooner or later, and I certainly hope sooner, get a cross-party recognition that we need a thorough review of all aspects of pensioner support in this country. And we don't just try and tinker with bits and pieces and say, oh, well, we'll change the triple lock, but we keep the rest. Or we'll do a bit of this now and then come back to it later. Because this is so important, especially in an aging society. And that we'll need to look at how the national insurance system promises you a pension later. Things like, at the moment, you get a full state pension after 35 years work or contribution record. Well, there's no way that that's a full working life. And especially, you know, if you started work at 16, by 51, you've got a full state pension. How does that make sense? Even if you started at 21, you know, early-ish 50s, you would have finished 45 years at least.
And there are people starting in the workplace now who could be living to 110. So the way in which, even just in terms of longevity, we're not really, nothing has really kept pace with science or with the way in which our lifestyles have changed.
Also, I think what is not recognised at all in the state pension system and needs to be part of this review is how you reflect people's health status in the concept of a state pension age. Because we still have a country where at least half of people are no longer healthy beyond their early-ish 60s. One in 10 are not healthy beyond their early 50s. Whereas the top one in 10, the top 10%, are perfectly fit and healthy until their early 70s nowadays. So can we recognise somehow perhaps the length of working life and health in the age at which society supports people, rather than forcing those who are not yet at the ever-rising state pension age, to live on out-of-work benefits when they simply can't work. And, you know, those are debates that can be had. Others will say, let's look at means testing. Others might say, well, you know, there's if you don't pay the people a pension, of course they're going to keep working because they have to. Work in some cases, but it certainly won't work in all. And in a country which has such a dreadful system, it could well leave a lot of people who need care, who could be cared for by family, uncared for because there's no other support for the family member who might have been able to do it. You know, there are lots of elements to this debate. It cannot and should not, in my view, be boiled down to what are we going to do about the triple lock? But unfortunately, politicians have driven down that path, and I hope we can row back on it.
Row back on the soundbite. That is a brilliant instruction for us to all take away. Baroness Ros Altman, CBE, thank you very much indeed for being on my couch today.
It's a pleasure. Lovely to be with you, Lucy.
And thank you for listening. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all of the things that help people hear about the On the Couch podcast. And do tell all your friends, and even people who aren't your friends, but maybe you want them to be. This is a podcast for Reaction.